Good morning. Our second case for today is 11AP2961D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Randy Netzer. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Netzer is Mr. Netzer, who's representing himself. You will have 25 minutes, Mr. Netzer, and then Matthew Aenig, who represents the Office of Lawyer Regulation, will have 30 minutes. And then, Mr. Netzer, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Netzer.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Thank you to all the justices for taking the time out of your day to listen to this case. Most of what I would like to respectfully convey to each and every one of you this morning has already been written in the briefs that have been filed, but it's important for me to be here today because I'm here because I do want to take responsibility for the mistakes that I've made. And in particular, I recognize that when I placed ads in the newspaper, there were consequences to that that I should have, at the time that I took that action, been mindful of. And I deeply regret having done that. I regret any problems that has caused anyone else. And even this court, the time that I'm taking away from your days to do other important things. Also, the time that Mr. Onich had to spend in dealing with this case and the Office of Lawyer Regulation had to deal with this case. Having said that, again, my argument is mostly what you see in the briefs. One of the keys is the fact, as I see it, that this case came before the Office of Lawyer Regulation, went through the investigation process really before it was ripe. As you may be aware from the facts, a judgment was issued, a conviction was entered in April of 2011. Subsequent to that, Office of Lawyer Regulation was notified, the Supreme Court was eventually notified, not in a timely manner, as they should have been, a couple days late. I apologize for that. But it was always my intent, once the conviction happened, to file for post-conviction relief. And I did that at the trial court level. And I discussed in numerous occasions with the Office of Lawyer Regulation that I felt that it was most appropriate to wait until the matter had fully been heard at the trial court level before Office of Lawyer Regulation got involved in the case. Specifically in my briefs, I pointed out some support for my feelings in this matter. I felt that the Office of Lawyer Regulation taking action on it did was premature because I felt there was a basis for waiting, that basis had been established simply by the fact that when the matter first came about, that I had received a written letter from the Office of Lawyer Regulation indicating that this matter could be put on hold until it was resolved, and I replied to that letter by saying that I agreed that that was probably the appropriate thing to do. The second argument for the matter being premature is the notion of estoppel, and I cited the case of DOR versus Mobius Printing at 89 Wisconsin 2nd 610, a 1979 case, which says that the government can be stopped from taking action just like an individual can. And my belief in estoppel is that I felt as if there was more or less a contractual agreement between the Office of Law Regulation and myself that because of that exchange of letters, we had decided that we were not going to be investigating the case and coming up with conclusions about the case until everything had passed through the trial court level. Perhaps one of the most important arguments, though, is a public policy argument that in any instance like this where something is not right, you're going to have issues where fairness come about, and most importantly, judicial economy. The last thing I would want to do is really be wasting time, and I think that that was what was happening in large part with the Office of Law Regulation. A lot of it was discussing with the Office of Law Regulation why we weren't at that final stage yet, but I thought that that could have all been avoided if we would have waited until the process had run its course.
Counsel, may I interject a question? Thank you.
Please.
The sanction here is for 90 days suspension. That's what has been recommended by the referee. 90 days of suspension. Okay. Tell me about your current practice of law and how that would affect your current practice of law. Obviously, there's 90 days of a suspension, but what's your current practice of law like?
My current practice of law is that I'm not actively practicing law. As a matter of fact, I decided when I was arrested on the original charges that I would stop at that point in time and, in essence, suspend my own license so that if anyone came to me and asked for legal advice or some kind of representation in any shape or form, that I didn't feel that it was appropriate until this matter got beyond resolution before I practiced law.
And when was that? I know there. Are you talking about the recent or the more recent charges? There's been two times when you've had charges, once in 2006. Do I recall correctly, where you got a private reprimand at that time?
You're correct that there was a private reprimand in 2006, but that dates back to events that occurred in the year 2000.
Okay. And when did you stop, in your mind, practicing law then, as a result of this?
I wouldn't be my typical definition of a practicing lawyer in the interim between then and now, because I wasn't hanging out a shingle and that sort of thing. I was still giving legal advice and from time to time representing people in small matters like traffic cases and that sort of thing, but I wasn't making a living at it. During most of the course of the last decade, I've been a general manager at a hotel, and I've ran a title company. I used my law license in both capacities, especially when I founded and ran the title company, you know, doing real estate, what I considered real estate law, doing legal descriptions and advising people, doing starter tax deferred exchanges and that kind of thing.
So currently, what is your employment?
As of this moment, because I'm not practicing law, I'm working part-time jobs.
Okay.
In fact, I got off of work at 1 o'clock this morning, and my family drove here today. We went off the road a little bit.
I don't want to hear about that. I'm just teasing.
No.
But so you came down from La Crosse?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to know what your current practice was, so you can go back to your...
I'm glad you raised that because looking forward, you know, if I can segue using that as a transition, the idea of a 90-day suspension as it was posed by the referee would, in my mind, likely be a much longer-term suspension. It might be a permanent disbarment in my case.
Why are you, do you think 90 days isn't going to be 90 days?
They were talking about, the referee in particular was talking about imposing conditions such as a psychiatric evaluation and whatever the psychologist or psychiatrist recommended, completing those phases before having a license reinstated and the cost involved. I would not have the money to pay those costs and so forth. So it effectively would probably be the end of my law license if that were to happen.
I'm sorry, what was the last part? You said you would what with your law license?
It might be the end of my law license if a 90-day suspension might be.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
What is it you want this court to do?
Well, I'd like the court to compare the cases that you've decided in the past for lawyer discipline. I believe that when you do that with the facts of my case, you'll see that the suspension is above and beyond what many similar cases would warrant. I think that I have made a mistake. You know, there's a reason why I'm here. I deserve to be here. You know, I deserve to be under your scrutiny. But I think that you look at comparable cases, and a public reprimand or a private reprimand would be more appropriate. I can cite the cases in particular. Radcliffe is a case that was cited specifically by Mr. Onich and OLR. That's a disciplinary case in which the gentleman, Mr. Radcliffe, an attorney in Wisconsin, had felony charges in Wisconsin and Illinois for drug manufacturing and was convicted of those charges. He also had a prior private disciplinary reprimand, as I have, and he received 90 days. He received the kind of suspension that is being suggested in my case, but he was convicted of a felony, and my case, not to discount the mistake that I made, but it's a violation of a restraining order. The case that's really the most on point that I found that I cited in my briefs was actually a case involving a private reprimand that was cited in May of 2011. Because it's a private reprimand, I don't have a citation for you. But in that case, the fact situation was you had an individual, an attorney, that was for the second time violating a restraining order, and that would be the exact same fact situation as my case. He had received a prior private reprimand, and now he was receiving a private reprimand as well.
Counsel, I hear you arguing that the appropriate sanction would be a private or public reprimand. There is the referee recommendation of 90 days. And what I want to do is find out where your real concern is. And it sounds to me that if you wouldn't be getting a private reprimand, that what you're most concerned with isn't whether it's 60 days or 90 days or 120 days, because you're not practicing law right now. But you seem to be concerned about the conditions. Now, correct me. I want to hear you. I don't want to hear me talk. But that's right. And the conditions, as I understand it, include from the referee that you have an evaluation, that you sign releases, that you cooperate with treatment, that you submit to monitoring by a person selected by WISLAP for 5 years, those kinds of conditions. You earlier said today that you wouldn't be able to do that because it would be cost prohibitive. So is it, if we were going to impose 90 days, if we were, Does it make much difference to you whether it be 60 or 90 or 120 or is it the conditions that bother you?
I guess you could impose any number of days or months or years even as a suspension, and your point is absolutely on target that as far as the conditions, that would be perhaps a bigger issue. And what one thing that I believe is, you know, I did make a mistake, and I have tried to resolve that in whatever ways that I could. I don't want to be here before you trying to rationalize the mistake that I made. I made a mistake. So I don't want to go down that road. But to try to deal with it internally, I have engaged a counselor. I have went to a psychiatrist. I have undergone that course and tried to, you know, improve as a person and be a better attorney because of that. You know, I can understand perhaps the need for an evaluation, that sort of thing. But, you know, I feel that I've learned from the mistake that I made. Having said that I don't want to rationalize putting the happy ads and that sort of thing, one of the reasons why we're here is because the attorney's fees are astronomical, and I think that they could have been avoided if this case was not prematurely jump-started. You know, there's a lot of precedent in the law with OLR cases that if you can work something out with the OLR, get a stipulation, have an agreement, that fees are usually not assessed. And so I made a good faith effort, I felt, to work with the OLR. And if you have access to the entirety of the file, I would hope that you would agree that, you know, I sent pages and pages of material. I was very detailed. I think I was very forthright and very honest and open about everything. And I tried to make things as clear as possible. And in fact, I think that even in the referee's report, it states that I did cooperate with the OLR.
Mr. What is it that was pending at the trial court level that you wanted OLR to wait on before they proceeded?
It was a post-conviction relief requesting a withdrawal of plea for a new trial or a modification of sentence. It got to the point where there was a Mockner hearing, and based upon that, I would argue that the judge that was handling the case, the Honorable Scott Horn in La Crosse County, that he saw that there was enough supporting evidence in my favor that a Mockner hearing was warranted, that I don't want to necessarily get into the details of that unless you want me to. I will say, though, that you know, the matter involving my prior attorney, I have taken to the OLR myself to ask them to help me resolve that. And as we went through this process, he wrote me an email that I've got a copy of, that he said that I got a better deal than what I deserved. And then after the fact, I worked out a plea bargain with the district attorney, which more measured up to what the actual facts of the case were. So
I thought, counsel, that you had reached a stipulation with OLR.
Yes, I did. But it took a lot of time, and of course, this process is the meter continues to run. So.
Right, and I thought that from your brief that one of the problems was that after you reached the stipulation, you didn't think that the stipulation was valid or appropriate and wasn't being read correctly.
This was the stipulation of facts.
Right.
Is that correct?
Exactly.
I think I stated many times in my briefs that I don't have an issue with the stipulation of fact. But to give you a few examples, I think the stipulation of fact, going from memory, recites, you know, that there was a criminal complaint. And all along, I said to Attorney Onich, you know, that I'd agree with that, that there was a criminal complaint, but there should be some kind of maybe some language that says that all the things that are in the criminal complaint aren't fact. And so we kind of went back and forth about that. So I don't have really an issue with the stipulation saying that there was a criminal complaint and people being able to read that and so forth, but I just had a concern that people were reading it as if the entirety of the criminal complaint, the way that it was, simply because the way that it was written, was accepted as being part of that stipulation of fact. All I'm saying is that there was a complaint, but that doesn't necessarily, just like any other innocent person, you know, if you're arrested for something, that doesn't, eventually there's going to be a criminal complaint, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you did the things that the complaint said. And so we kind of went back and forth about things like that. So.
But there was a conviction.
The ultimate conviction was for placing two happy ads in a newspaper, yes. And I don't want to diminish that because, first of all, I recognize the ramifications that may have had on the victim, and I feel very sad about that. And secondly, I take these things very seriously because, you know, violating a restraining order, that's an order of the court. And myself, as an officer of the court, I certainly want to be above that. I want to set an example, not violating court orders. So,
are you here today, and I know the issues that have been put forth in your brief in terms of the prematureness and the stipulation of facts and et cetera, but are you here today to say to this court, we should not suspend your license? Or are you here today to say to this court that we shouldn't impose costs or any conditions that would be costly to you, or both?
Well, as far as the former goes, as you referenced earlier, a suspension, whether you issue it or not, that kind of goes above my pay grade. I think I defer to your wisdom as far as that goes, and that's why I cite the cases that I do, because I think that when you look at the cases, if justice is fair, and you know, I don't always give it credit for that, but if justice were fair, based upon the precedents that have been set before, and I can read off, there's Glodowski, was a case that was similar to mine where she had a private reprimand, and I can cite the case number.
That's okay. I've taken a look at
okay.
this.
Okay. In that case, she had a private reprimand previously, and now she was being charged with misdemeanors, just like I was being charged with misdemeanors, different nature to the misdemeanors. Hers were drug-related and so forth. She, I believe, received a private reprimand, that sort of thing. If the court wants to give me a public reprimand, private reprimand, or a suspension, I guess that's not as, you know, I'm not here to argue that again. It's up to your wisdom to decide what's best suited for that. The attorney's fees I do have a problem with because I had the feeling that I was cooperating with the OLR. I guess I had anticipated that from the very beginning that we'd be able to work out a stipulation of fact. Again, you know, I may have went about it wrong, but I'm fine with the stipulation of facts. It's just, I guess I worry about how someone might interpret or whatever. But I didn't see the need that we had to keep on going back and forth for that. I thought that we could have, and especially if the OLR would have decided at my request and based upon the estoppel principles and so forth that I felt were in place, the contract that we had already that was in existence, that they would wait until the matter was ripe. If at that point we had come to a resolution, the facts would have been a lot clearer. There would have been the judicial economy of dealing with it. And so it would have been relatively inexpensive, I think, for the OLR to work with me, because I'm admitting that there's a mistake I made. And I can't undo the past. You know, I can try to move forward in the best that I can. But, you know, I trust your wisdom. I mean, if you feel it's necessary to suspend me, I would only ask that you give me credit for the time that, you know, I could have been working and I've chose to not use my license because out of respect for that. The institution, I didn't feel it was proper.
How long was that, counsel?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Pardon me?
I,
how long did you choose not to use your license?
Well, from the day that I was arrested, okay. Which was March of 2010.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Your red light is on, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
UF Amy, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the Court, I'm Matt Onich from Ashland. I'm retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this proceeding. There were four issues raised in Mr. Netzer's appeal. The first one is whether the OLR prematurely filed the disciplinary complaint. As I understand it, the OLR sent Mr. Netzer a letter in April of 2010 and stated they received information there were criminal charges pending against him. They asked for a response. They said they were starting an investigation, and they advised him he had a right to not incriminate himself. He responded saying that he was exercising that right and wouldn't answer questions while the criminal proceeding was going on. The OLR suspended its investigation for a while, for about 11 months. It then learned that Mr. Netzer had been convicted of a couple crimes in La Crosse County, so it sent him a letter, said they're reopening their investigation. And then while their investigation was going on, he did file motions in both cases to modify sentence or in the alternative withdraw his plea. He did that in July. The OLR filed a disciplinary complaint December 27th, which is about 8 months after his criminal convictions. He now says the OLR should not have filed the complaint because the criminal cases were not fully completed. And he argues basically the OLR should have suspended its investigation a second time. We don't believe that the OLR complaint was premature. The OLR complaint is based on conduct and not based strictly on the criminal convictions. It is true that SCR 22.20 sub 5 does say a certified copy of a conviction is conclusive evidence of his guilt. But the OLR knew when they filed the complaint in December of 2011 that he had admitted the conduct of four crimes, two of which were felonies. Now, those two felonies were read in and dismissed, but he nevertheless admitted the underlying conduct of four crimes. We don't think that it is good public policy. He basically wants to create a situation where an attorney who has a criminal charge pending has an advantage over one who doesn't, but the criminal charges are in a completely different realm than the disciplinary proceeding. There isn't a criminal charge in most disciplinary proceedings. A criminal conviction is not necessary. There's a different burden of proof, and as a practical matter, all the charges could have been dismissed, and he still would have had admitted to committing four crimes. He didn't file any motion with the referee raising this issue. Whether it's considered waiver or a forfeiture of the right to do that is a matter of terminology, but he did not preserve that issue for appeal. You, of course, have the right to decide the issue if you see fit, but we would contend that he did not preserve that issue. His proposition really makes no sense since he's admitted to misconduct. The complaint that was filed by the OLR was proper based on that, and the criminal case was almost irrelevant at that issue, or at that point. In his second issue, he asked whether the stipulation of facts drafted by the OLR is appropriate. I'm not sure what to say about his argument that it introduces facts not in evidence, because the facts are basically put in evidence by the stipulation. I drafted a stipulation of facts that tracked the criminal or the disciplinary complaint and sent it to him. He had issues with that. We went back and forth, but he is an extremely verbose individual and extremely detail-oriented and made requests that, in my mind, were not reasonable, and we spent a lot of time and effort going back and forth on that.
Counsel?
Yes.
In that regard, given your brief experience, you know, in this matter, questions arose in my mind about the conditions of the referee, 5 years monitoring, complying. Is that realistic in this case, or is it a recipe for a very difficult future in terms of a very thick file and not being able to pay and maybe tactfully, and I won't say it tactfully, I'll just be blunt, a case that's going to be coming back and coming back and coming back potentially for non-compliance or inability to comply. 5 years is a long time. So it seems out of proportion to me. Of 90-day suspension.
We didn't really have a sanction hearing. The sanctions issue were submitted by briefs. I didn't have a lot of information about Mr. Netzer or his condition. The OLR consulted with WISLAP, I think is her name, Linda Albert, over there, and she suggested the assessment and the other conditions that the OLR came up with here. The OLR was not attempting to recommend an excessive or disproportionate sentence here. We know that he had been referred to assessments before with a criminal case, and presumably if an assessment was ordered, the assessor might consult with other assessment reports and see what's gone on in the past. It's my understanding, as far as a matter of costs, it's a standard procedure in the Supreme Court rules to impose the costs. You, of course, do have a right not to impose all the costs, and the OLR is commonly involved in people that don't pay the costs. He's certainly right that if we'd reached a stipulation up front and didn't have to spend a lot of time on this case, there wouldn't have been the costs. Attorneys find themselves in the middle. If you come in unprepared, you're criticized, and if you spend time on the case, you get criticized for running up the bill. But I can assure you at $70 an hour, my share of the office overhead is more than that. The more hours I spend on an OLR case, the more money I lose. I didn't spend time on this case unnecessarily, but I'd simply, for example, write and get a copy of his motions in those two criminal cases, and I think each one's 100 pages. He's an extremely verbose individual, and he just spend a lot of time on it. And he talks like if we had suspended the case a second time, we would have spent less time on it. I don't think that's the case. He hasn't identified to me any fact that it was different because of the decision in La Crosse County as compared with before the decision.
Counsel, OLR pays your bill.
Yes.
And OLR then gets, if it can, repaid by the respondent here.
Yes.
And also the orders generally say something to the effect that if you can't pay costs and you want to come back in, you should work with OLR so that your costs can be paid over a time period.
Yes.
So assuming that the 90 days is correct, which may or may not be correct, but assuming that, and assuming that the costs, which are about $4,000 here, if I have it right, could be paid over time and would not keep Mr. Netzer out of the bar, what does raise a problem for him in compliance and in money are the other conditions. Right?
Yes.
And what also raises a problem for the court is that should these conditions not be complied with, then Mr. Netzer is going to be back here. Right?
I believe that they come back to court, though, when
that's
it's
right.
a refusal to pay as opposed to an inability to pay.
Right. But I mean, if he does not comply with the conditions, he's going to be back here on failing to comply with conditions and that the 90 days should be extended. Is that right?
That's certainly a possibility,
right.
Yes.
In fact, we've got a rules petition relating to how the court should get compliance with its orders. Excuse me. So, my question is, what is the basis of the referee's conditions?
Well, the referee, under his heading basis for recommendation, indicated he had serious concerns about Mr. Netzer's fitness to practice law. He said the nature of the offenses for which he's been convicted over several years with two women raised questions about his mental health. That his responses to the complaint and his statements in his sanction brief and sanction brief revised cause additional concern about mental health and fitness to practice law. He said there was a delusional dimension to his explanations and statements that underscore the need for a psychological evaluation and subsequent progress and treatment before he'll have the psychological fitness to practice law.
I apologize to you, but OLR did not seek a medical suspension.
No.
And so what's the authority of the referee under a straight suspension request that the referee impose conditions relating to mental health?
Well, of course, the referee is only making recommendations.
Right,
you would make the decision.
Okay, I'll make it broader. What's our authority when we don't have a medical incapacity complaint?
I believe that one of the options for discipline are things such as reprimands, but also SCR 21.16 sub 1 MD talks about conditions on the continued practice of law. It goes down the list about, you know, most serious revocation, suspension, reprimands, public or private, then conditions on the continued practice of law, and I believe that that would be the authority. It'd be 21.16.
All right. Even if, was there any medical testimony at before the referee regarding the mental health of Mr. Netzer?
No. Mr. Netzer was aware he had the right to a hearing on the issue of sanction. Both sides stipulated to be done by written submissions and briefs, and that's what occurred here. So the OLR doesn't have a lot of information about what the result of the assessment might be. Maybe they'll say that he's fine and doesn't need much in terms of treatment or supervision, or maybe it won't be that way. I don't know.
Counsel, you came in, OLR came into this case asking for a 90-day suspension. Am I correct on that? Your complaint asked for a 90-day suspension.
That's correct.
That's right. And then you have the referee making the statements that he made, like that you just referenced.
Yes.
Question the fitness to practice law. Concerns about mental health. And then comes up with 90 days. So oftentimes a referee who has concerns about someone's fitness to practice law, not because of a discrete violation, but overall fitness to practice law, there seems like a disconnect with a 90-day suspension. Can you help me with that? I mean, my sense is the train left the station with 90 days, and that's what it arrived with also. But in the meantime, the referee heard testimony and had questions about fitness to practice law.
I can't speak for the referee, obviously. I don't know much beyond
what he states.
But as I understand it, he's suggesting that if there's an assessment, there would be things that would follow up with that. For example, number four says, comply with treatment recommendations in the report of the psychological evaluation ordered. So the thought was that this gal at WISLAP is experienced and trained enough to direct him to a proper person to do the assessment, and that the assessor would make recommendations as far as treatment and monitoring and things like that that would be appropriate. Now, what those treatment and monitoring recommendations would be, I don't know. There really wasn't testimony at a sanction hearing about that.
Don't we have to have some kind of factual basis to get into these kinds of conditions? Otherwise, anytime someone is subject to discipline by the OLR and there's a call to WISLAF, they can suggest a whole string of things. But don't they have to rest on some kind of a factual foundation for the particular person for which they're being recommended?
Well, as I read the referee's recommendation, there were certain concerns that he had based on the way things progressed that made him feel it was appropriate to have this assessment done. Now, I don't think the assessment is an extremely lengthy thing to do, but hopefully the person doing the assessment can look at the other assessments that have been done as well and come to some conclusions about what's appropriate. And if they say that he's fine, presumably they're not going to be recommending a bunch of treatment or monitoring. And if there are red flags or concerns, presumably they'll make appropriate treatment and monitoring suggestions.
21.17 says, the license of an attorney may be suspended indefinitely. We're not at that. A license of an attorney may be conditions, or may have conditions, may be imposed on the attorney's practice of law with the attorney's consent, and there isn't here, I gather, or upon a finding that the attorney has a medical incapacity pursuant to the procedures set forth in 22, in Chapter 22, and I'm not sure that those procedures have been followed. So that's what's bothering me here. I mean, you can argue that the 90 days are or are not the appropriate sanction. bought without any medical testimony, without any anything in the record per se, other than the defendant's conduct and the referee saying this is a problem, I have a problem. I have a question because these are conditions that are difficult to meet. They are time-consuming. They might be costly. He may or may not be able to meet them. And 22.34 deals with attorney medical incapacity proceeding, and it's done on confidence, and there's a whole procedure set forth here. And none of that was followed.
There is a SCR 22.16 sub 4 that talks about if in the course of a proceeding the respondent claims incapacity, that the referee can conduct a hearing on that basis, but that did not occur here.
That's
either.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the...
But I believe the referee's thought was that having the assessment done would provide the information that could drive whatever else is appropriate after that.
I understand that, and you can certainly understand why the referee reached that conclusion on the basis of the history here. But I'm wondering if the procedure was correct. Suppose the referee, in hearing this, came to the conclusion that a medical competence report was needed or incapacity report was needed. Could the referee order that himself and order the information brought in to the referee?
Well, as I read 22.16 sub 4A, it talks about if the respondent claims an incapacity, then the referee.
I know, yeah.
That didn't occur here.
No, I know that. So I'm just wondering whether you don't have to, he didn't have to follow 2234. So we have had a number of cases, Mr. Anish, as you very well know, where the referee and then the court imposes drug counseling, drug tests, medical tests, and it just never come through as blatantly as this, as to what the authority for doing that is. In all of those, the testing was very much related to the offense, usually incompetence of the lawyer or failing to communicate because there's a drug issue or there's depression. And then the referee orders as a condition something medical and drug related.
I believe that all three of the cases that Mr. Netzer attached to his supplemental appendix, there were substances involved with the Radcliffe and that Gladowski and the Carmichael cases were all.
Yeah, and that's pretty typical here. I mean, not every case, but many.
As far as point two, he questions whether the stipulation of facts drafted by the OLR is appropriate, and he had comments about the criminal complaint being attached. My submission to him had the same language as in the complaint. He didn't like number five, so I revised it. He didn't like five again, so I revised it, and then he sent me an email suggesting we hook the complaint on, so I did that, and now he's critical of it. The third issue is whether the referee's report and recommendation was faulty or defective. The referee hooked the findings of fact right onto his report. Our stipulation of facts provides for the referee to adopt the violations as conclusions. He did that. I don't know what else the referee was supposed to have done when he's presented with that. I believe the cases that he's cited can be distinguished on the facts because he admitted to conduct involving four crimes, two of which were felonies, and none of the cases that he's hooked onto his supplemental appendix are as serious in that regard. As far as issues that he raised in his presentation, he thought that if the OLR had waited longer, it would have saved money. I've seen no indication of that is the case. He was critical of his attorneys. I submit his attorneys recognize the fact that he could have been convicted of a felony stalking in this case and thought it was to his advantage to take a plea on the misdemeanors. He feels the OLR recommendation is disproportionate or excessive, but I don't think that it has been trying to be that way with him. The first time he had 7 counts against him, he was convicted of 2, and they recommended a private reprimand, which is what he received. Now, this time, it's the same sort of conduct that went on, same stalking sort of behavior, and they're seeking the 90-day suspension, and I believe it's warranted based on the information set forth in our sanction brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ames. Any questions?
Could I, what other kind of statuses besides active could an attorney could consider? I mean, what happens if you're on inactive status?
I guess I'm not certain.
For instance, would it be necessary if Attorney Netzer decided to go to inactive status to have all those conditions?
Yeah, I guess I'm not really well versed on inactive status. I'm sorry. I don't think the OLR was trying to suspend him for the rest of his life the way he talked, so. Presumably, even if there was monitoring involved, that could continue while you practice law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Danish. Mr. Netzer, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Thank you again, Your Honor. Rather quickly, I just want to address a few things. The 100 pages... for my filings, that is a gross exaggeration. I never made a filing of more than 5 or 6 pages. To say 100 pages, that, unfortunately, I don't know why he wants to exaggerate that much.
Counselor, I think he was talking about the motions in the criminal court.
But they would have never been more than 5 or 6 pages. So 100 pages is not accurate. To let the court know, Your Honor, Chief Justice,
yes,
you had indicated that $4,000 was the costs. It was up to over $6,000 before this hearing,
okay.
And so now I extrapolate it's probably going to be more like $8,000 or $10,000. And then
I'll check that, Counsel. That's a good point.
Then the crux would be admitting 4 crimes. That was the reason for the post-conviction relief. My attorney didn't, I don't want to rationalize why I'm here. I'm here because I made a mistake. I put a couple happy ads in the paper. If I had to do it all over again, I would not have done it. The felony charges, bail jumping was one. It is addressed in my brief. I was more than 1,400 feet away from the place where my ex-girlfriend was supposed to be working at a place where I had no visual. It was at 10 o'clock at night, hours after her workplace would have been closed. So I wasn't there to stalk her, and I had, at the time that this happened, no idea that where I was in an exclusion zone because where I was right next to the Cooley Region Humane Society, which was a humane society deal, and I volunteered every Monday helping them with their cats and everything, and I had advised the justice sanctions of that in advance, and they said that it was okay to be where I was. So that's the reason why I took post-conviction relief, and there was never any intent on my part to knowingly and voluntarily admit to any read-ins, and the read-ins didn't have any merit. And it's fine for Attorney Onich to say that we discipline people on conduct, not just criminal action, and I fully agree with that. You know, if someone's conduct is wrong, there needs to be consequences to that. And I'm here standing before you saying that the happy ads were wrong, and I'm asking for your mercy with that. But those are the things that I permitted. The other things, I did not.
Counsel, one of the counts, as I recall, is that you notified OLR of your conviction late. You were late in notification.
That's true.
It was about 2 weeks late. Am I right or wrong on that? Tell me
no,
about how much it was.
I can't remember what the rule is even now, if it's 5 days or whatever. But I was 2 days late.
2 days late.
Getting notice to the OLR. And then OLR notified me that I needed to also notify the Supreme Court, so I Federal expressed a notice to the but all through the process, I was communicating with the OLR, letting them know, you know, I did make that mistake. But some of the other cases that I cited, Mr. Onich respectfully talks about how all these other cases are drug cases, but that's not true. The case that is most on all fours with my case is the private reprimand, where a person is being private reprimanded for a second time, and they were all on violating a restraining order, which is essentially my case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Netzer. As you know, Mr. Netzer, OLR discipline cases for lawyers are extremely important, not only to the lawyer and to the court, but to the public. And we appreciate that you have appeared and that you have filed your brief and have made argument with us. And we appreciate that Mr. English is again representing the OLR in this case. He is taken under advisement by the court. And this concludes our hearing today of the Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Randy Netzer. The court is in recess until 1:30, when it will have oral argument in the third case today. We are in recess.